science is so intertwined with politics, and that kind of lethal cocktail has gotten us to where we are today.
Welcome to A Certain Age, a show for women who are unafraid to age out loud. Beauties, if you've spent more than 5 minutes in midlife, you know that adding more birthday candles to every cake means learning about a whole host of issues that you were totally blind to in your younger years. Osteoporosis, retirement, aging parents, menopause, all begin to take center stage, right? Take on urgency, fuel our actions, our efforts, even our outrage. It's the midlife before and after. One day we're moving through the world unaware that our estrogen is exiting. The next, we are scrambling for tools, resources, and tubes of vaginal estrogen. My guest today is a woman with a long history of looking at the before picture and working to transmute it into a better after. Jennifer Weiss-Wolf is a lawyer and social justice activist. She's the executive director of the Birnbaum Women's Leadership Center at NYU School of Law. She was the first Women in Democracy Fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. She also leads partnerships at Ms., the OG feminist magazine. She's an author, an advocate, and a frequent writer on gender and politics in America. She's been called the architect of the U.S. campaign to squash the tampon tax. And she's written the book, Periods Gone Public, Taking a Stand for Menstrual Equity, which chronicles the fight for menstrual care to be seen as healthcare. Now she is helping lead the charge for menopause care to be seen as essential healthcare. Yes, please. We are eagerly awaiting her latest book, Period, Full Stop, The Politics of Menopause, which is slated for publication next year. She joins me today to give us a landscape view of the politics of menstruation, to share how current laws, tax codes, and even our workplaces and healthcare systems impact the care we have access to. And she shares easy ideas for getting involved with the fight to ensure that science-backed menopause care is available to everyone who needs it. Welcome, Jennifer.
Hi there. So glad to be here.
Well, I am super excited. This is such an important conversation. I'm thrilled that you're joining me today to share more. I know that you've been involved with the politics and policies of menstruation for a decade plus, right? It began with periods and is ending, as all periods do, with menopause. As a jumping off point, can you share how you first got started in the fight against the tampon tax?
Sure. And it's fun to hear it described that way because it is a pretty obvious evolution. Although nothing about it, I guess, has seemed obvious when you would think about even just having a career as a lawyer, that either menstruation or menopause will play a starring role. But they really have. I think it's the issue that has tied together all of the things that I care about, whether it's democracy, participation, justice, equality, our health, our well-being. Menstruation and menopause are just inextricably connected, and actually at the heart of all of it. So I've been doing menstruation-related law and policy work, I guess, for a decade. 2015 was when it began for me. The tampon tax is one of the issues that I have worked on and helped to conceptualize and frame, but it's one of many, and all of the puzzle pieces are actually really important because there is, sort of similar to menopause, there is no one silver bullet. And all of it sort of implicates and leans on each other. But for me, it was a decade ago. It was literally January 1st, 2015. It was New Year's Day. And I have this resolution tradition that I do each year to ensure that I keep my resolutions. And as I always joke, turn them into revolutions. But I go swimming on New Year's Day in the Atlantic Ocean at Coney Island, with all the other sort of nutty polar bear plungers in Brooklyn. In 2015, I'd actually gone dressed as Wonder Woman, which has also become a tradition ever since. My friends and I that year just decided we needed even more of a jolt than the cold ocean might provide. And I was doing what every, I guess, person who would do something as silly as that would follow the day with, which was posting my pictures online. And while I was doing that, I stumbled across another post from a mom in my community who, with her two teenage daughters, was collecting tampons and pads for our local food pantry. And I was just so stunned by the post and everything that it stood for, everything that it implicated, that I just kind of stopped in my tracks. I always joke, I think I did get the pictures up, but I immediately just started reading and researching and questioning and wondering, and reached out to the family. I wanted to participate in what they were doing. But right away, I saw it as potentially more than just, you know, a donation drive or a philanthropic contribution. But there was a systemic failure that was so obvious in this request for products. Why it would be that there would be a recognized need from an organization that had budget dollars allocated, and why it would rely on kids to be out there collecting something that was as essential to its clients as everything else it provided. So I started, actually, that was where I came up with this idea that using public writing was a real tool for policy advocacy, that if the people didn't know there was a problem, they certainly couldn't focus on a solution. And if government and lawmakers didn't know that people supported this solution, they wouldn't want to get involved in it. So the very first piece I wrote, and this was really the start of my career as a writer, as well as a lawyer and an advocate, was an op-ed for the New York Times on why menstrual products not only are essential, I think the answer is obvious, but why that designation as being essential means they need different treatment from our government and the laws by which we live. So I started really trying to envision and imagine what all of those policies would be. I mean, some of them seem obvious now because they have become so popular that we just assume that that's what should be done. But at the time, there was nothing, like literally absolutely zero, that the government was doing or saying when it came to menstruation. So the tampon tax, or that's the colloquial term for when menstrual products are not exempt from sales tax and other items that are deemed necessities are, was one of the policy reforms that seemed kind of ripe for the asking. It was already happening in other parts of the world. I connected with folks who were doing the work in Canada, in England, in Australia. Those were places where advocacy was already underway.
And Jennifer, when you say other items that, you know, are exempt from these taxes, you know, these are items that are deemed medically necessary, right? Like in doing my research, I learned that, like, saline, you know, for example, for people who are using contacts, you can have, they're medically exempt products that aren't taxed. And yet at this time, right, is that correct, that tampons were taxed?
So it's not only that other medically necessary items were exempt from sales tax, but there were and still are many, many items that I think listeners might agree do not amount to a necessity that are exempt from sales tax.
Like what?
So some that are sort of used for like a punchline are that Rogaine and Viagra are tax exempt.
Okay, enough said. I get it. I'm like retroactively angry.
But I will say that why they are tax exempt, the wonk in me needs to explain that they're tax exempt because they're prescription medications.
Got it. So it's
not so much that there was a value judgment made, although that's not the biggest leap to take. But I actually did, again, I'm super wonky and these things give me great pleasure to explore. But I actually read in great depth the sales tax code of all 50 states so I could find items to compare menstrual products to. And okay, so here we go. Sunflower seed, barbecued sunflower seeds, fruit roll-ups, vending machine snacks, gun club memberships, cowboy boots on sales tax holidays. All of these things qualify for an exemption in various states, and menstrual products in 40 of the 50 states, this was in 2015, did not.
And it's beyond, I think, even just the tax, isn't it? Is this correct? Because I think I read that at the time, like you couldn't use food stamps to buy menstrual products.
Yeah, and you still can't. And again, I'll give the very sort of technical description why is that the SNAP program, which is what we call food stamps, is administered by the Department of Agriculture, and it really is intended only to apply to groceries. WIC, Women, Infants, and Children program, also doesn't include menstrual products for mothers who are often postpartum and bleeding quite heavily. There are a lot of system failures. The agenda items or the policies that became the most active and garnered the most support quickly were policies that ensured that publicly funded services and agencies included menstrual products for the people who use them. So that would include, for example, departments of education, meaning that they need to be provided for students in school because they're generally not. It means that departments of correction have to ensure that people who are incarcerated, who have no agency or access to anything, sometimes menstrual products in the commissary that are very jacked up in price, but otherwise there was not a requirement and is not a requirement in many jails and prisons that menstrual products.
Jennifer, we're heading into a quick break, but when we come back, I want to pick this up and I want you to let us know what has changed since you first got involved with menstruation equity in 2015.
Sure.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read, a podcast about the books that built our souls. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. Don't miss it. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hannah to Jhumpa Lahiri, Susie Essman, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they talk, they share. You can join us on Instagram for more behind-the-scenes content and giveaways at You Are What You Read Podcast and at Adriana Trigiani. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Bedside Matters is the podcast for all the latest medical news and answers to your questions. Hosted by respected physician Dr. David Kipper, comedian Anna Vecchino, and writer-producer Peter Tilden. Plus, we have special guests like Danny DeVito.
I was marveling. It was such a life-saving moment. You like Houdini.
Steve Martin and Martin Short.
We were working and Marty had this Christmas opportunity to fly home and see his grandkids and his children. And he gets off the plane and has COVID.
It was a Home Alone sequel, except for a seven-year-old with COVID.
Charlie Day.
David, thanks for keeping me alive, and thanks for keeping Danny alive so we could keep the show on the air for as long as possible.
And many more. New episodes of Bedside Matters drop every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Jennifer, we're back from the break. You were listing all of the different ways that the lack of access to menopause products impacts women or people with vaginas across our society. They weren't at one point available in schools. They weren't available in correction facilities. What has happened to change with menstruation equity since you first picked up this mantle in 2015?
It's become a national and global movement. It's really extraordinary. There has been a huge amount of support. It's been largely bipartisan. So it's not just been a blue state issue or progressive issue. There's been real recognition across the aisle that this is an important policy agenda. So at this point, every state in the country has introduced some form of legislation to ensure either that menstrual products are tax-free or that they are provided in key agencies like schools, jails, shelters. There have been probably as many wins. Not every state has achieved every reform that it's introduced, but at least 40 states have passed some form of legislation doing one of these things. Even the federal government and Congress has acted. And you'd be surprised. You might think it's this Congress or a Democrat-led Congress or a Democratic presidency where this happened. But truth be told, it was Mitch McConnell's Senate and the former occupant of the White House's presidency where we saw the first two ever federal reforms pass. to ensure menstrual access, a criminal justice bill in 2018 called the First Step Act that mandated menstrual product provision to women who are incarcerated in federal prisons. And then when the pandemic started, the first stimulus package called the CARES Act included this very sort of wonky provision that I proposed back in 2015 and had never really seen the light of day, but suddenly found its way into the stimulus package, whereby the IRS tax code designation for menstrual products, different from sales tax, but how the IRS tax code defined them, which was prior like a grooming item and changed to a medical item, had the practical impact of meaning that if you have an FSA, flexible spending account, or a health savings account, HSA, those items would be eligible for pre-tax dollar reimbursements.
This is such an important victory, and it's so wonderful to hear that it was bipartisan in nature and that one political party doesn't have to be in power to have people recognize that these changes need to get made. And it makes us optimistic that we can move forward with menopause. So let's switch gears. We said at the beginning of the show that you began your journey in sort of women's health equity. You've had an extensive career in that, but you've really focused on this in 2015 with menstruation equity. We're now moving into menopause. You've written extensively about the need for menopause to be a public health policy. So this is a two-part question. One, why is menopause research and delivery of care, which is kind of a five-alarm fire in this country, why is it largely overlooked as a public health issue? And two, what do you see as the role of policymaking in menopause equity?
Yeah, so it was interesting. In 2020, during the pandemic, that was when I went through the menopause transition. Interestingly, I did not have the sort of wide array of symptoms that I know impact a lot of people. It felt sort of sudden to me because it felt like it came about unexpectedly, but it did cause me to start sort of thinking and talking more about menopause. And that triggered, of course, the idea of, well, what is the public policy landscape for menopause? I really had no idea. Which sounds surprising for somebody who focused so squarely on menstruation, but I guess it's sort of, that's part of our landscape, right? I hadn't given menopause much thought.
It's the before and after we talked about, right? It's not until you're in the after that you look around and you're like, wait a minute, this shouldn't be the way it is.
Exactly. Just like I always say, the menstruation sort of epiphany changed my life, so too did this menopause epiphany. But what was really surprising and interesting to me is how different the policy agendas or landscapes are and how much harder the menopause ecosystem, I think, feels to crack. So this is the way I've described it, you know, as I think about what the difference is. When it comes to menopause, the biggest barrier is stigma. And dismantling the stigma turned out to be not as hard as it might imagine for what was otherwise like a millennia of stigma. But for menopause, it is this sticky combination of stigma and lack of science. And the science is the much harder part, I think, to communicate and to wrap our heads around and to also acknowledge and understand that science is so intertwined with politics, and that kind of lethal cocktail has gotten us to where we are today. It's not that menopause was ignored in the latter part of the 20th century, either by science or by government, but a lot of missteps were made. And I know folks have come, you know, on your show and you've spoken with them about the Women's Health Initiative and all that led to it and what the aftermath has been. But it's a much harder to untangle aftermath when it comes to public policy than I think I probably appreciated when I started taking on this work. But I have absolutely come to believe that working our way back from the debacle of the WHI in 2002 is critical to all of the different kinds of reforms that we have available at our disposal that we need to press on, and why there have been so many systemic failures that require these policy interventions. It's kind of hard to say because it's a chicken and an egg thing, and it's consistently hard to figure out which came first.
Jennifer, for people who are new to the show and are joining us and have not heard about the Women's Health Initiative and don't understand its impact on current menopause science, can you catch them up?
So the real quick story is that the modern history of estrogen and menopausal hormone treatment in our country, it had a lot of ebbs and flows through the latter part of the 20th century, starting with sort of an explosion of popularity in the late 60s and early 1970s. Some studies and observational research that kept indicating that on the one hand, there were a lot of potential strong health benefits that would be associated with it in the here and now, if somebody needed to have menopause symptoms addressed and also in the towards their future health as they aged, but that there were also potential risks that needed to be better understood and guarded against. By the early 1990s, the federal government was persuaded by women political leaders that we needed to have affirmative answers for this. And the National Institutes of Health undertook what was the largest study ever, including women. It also marked the first time women were included in this kind of clinical research. And the study wasn't to understand if menopausal hormone treatments were good for treating menopause symptoms. That was already established. It was to understand the different potential health benefits and risks. But by 2002, the study was abruptly halted with a very loud press conference intended, it seems, to really alarm people with the announcement that a particular arm of it, the estrogen plus progestin study, was being halted because there were too many risks associated with both breast cancer and heart health. That announcement absolutely just changed the tide. It scared and stopped people in their tracks. And it took some unpacking in real time for folks to realize that it was not accurately presented and the fears that were instilled were unwarranted.
But by the time this was debunked, you have 10 years, 20 years of women really moving away from HRT as a solution. And it also had a chilling effect, I understand, on research, you know, the kind of scientific research that we need to really deliver accurate care.
It's more than even that people stopped using it and research stopped. Everything that is part of the systemic failures that we see today are at least to one or two degrees reflected in or an outcome of that period of time.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I know it's really hard to say clearly. So this is a good opportunity for me to keep digging in on that clarity. So I've identified five areas of public life that have been impacted by that. And it might not seem obvious that they have, but if you look at it carefully, you can see that it has. So for example, the way that menopause is taught to physicians or people who administer medical care, we see the statistics, how lacking it is, that only 20% of medical students or residents actually ever have any kind of menopause curriculum or are taught anything about menopause. And that doesn't include in random specialties that might not seem connected to menopause, but that includes for OBGYNs, for internists, for future doctors who are dealing in cardio health or endocrine health. So the lack of real both instruction and clinical experience in menopause is rooted in the fact that when doctors stopped prescribing MHT, it created a vacuum for also learning about it. There's also this, it's been called the menopause gold rush by more headlines than I can count. This like rapidly emerging menopause commercial arena that's worth billions now and is slated to be worth many more billions, you know, in the years to come as we Gen X and women of our age are a ripe demographic. But it is not just that folks may be using predatory advertising or selling fake science, but they're absolutely capitalizing on the confusion that people have about menopause hormone therapy or other interventions. When you're confused and you don't have a doctor who can answer your questions, it's likely that you'll see a product that promises something that sounds like it'll, you know, cure your ills. And that's what
Absolutely.
You'll turn to.
No, totally. Because there's a deficit. There's a wide gulf between what women need and what they have access to.
Right. And so all of these things can be traced back that way. It's not just that we're a demographic that I think Forbes called Gen X women super consumers. That might have been the phrase, which has made me laugh because it feels like the only time Gen X has gotten like credit for anything. Like we're the forgotten generation, the ignored generation. We're sort of proud of it. So it's funny to me to see that there's all this attention paid to what big footprint we're going to have in changing, you know, the menopause commerce space.
We're super across all spheres, not just consumption.
Exactly.
So Jen, so you said there were five errors. So one was med school instruction. So there's just sort of a deficit of information that people who are healthcare practitioners have gotten. Two, there's been this commercialization, right, of menopause that private companies have rushed into the gap and care to offer products and services, which sometimes help and sometimes are snake oil. So what would be number like 3, 4, and 5 that you identified?
So, and we're doing this actually even in reverse order because those two I think are extremely important, but they're yes. sort of collateral. So I'm going to actually explain the third collateral, which is related to that, and then get to the 4 and 5, which in my book are 1 and 2, literally in my head, but also in the book that I'm writing. So number 3, working backwards then, would be the private sector as well, but in the case of workplace benefits or accommodations in the workplace. That is another area where we've seen so much attention paid. If there are as many menopause, as, you know, Gold Rush menopause articles, the next headline I've seen, you know, ad nauseum is, you know, menopause-friendly workplaces. And while I think that's sort of interesting, I suppose that there is an acknowledgement that our contributions to the economy and the workplace are important and deserve to be considered. I would similarly say that this lack of education and common knowledge around both menopause and the ways it presents itself in people and what some of the obvious or future investments we need to make around solutions, these workplace interventions often, I think, just don't really meet the need. A lot of times they come across as sounding sort of two-dimensional or even silly, that fans will be provided and cooling rooms will be provided. When we think about sort of what the ebb and flow of our workday is, and our workdays can look different in a million different ways depending if we work in an office, if we work in a classroom, if we work behind a sales counter, if we work behind the wheel of a bus, the idea that there's a one-size-fits-all set of accommodations or
that there's a cooling room, you know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you just
right.
ID like this. If you're a bus driver, if you're working as a toll booth conductor behind the counter of your local 7-Eleven, there are no cooling rooms.
Right. And sometimes there's not even equitable or reasonable policy about things like bathroom breaks. So there's a lot to do when it comes to workplace equity. And I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon in this space, mostly when I show up in talks and hear people talk about, there's a lot of applause for the CEOs who are doing this. I think they're kind of missing the mark, quite honestly. And if they do want to invest in a more equitable future when it comes to menopause, getting behind items number 1 and 2 would be, I think, much more meaningful contributions. I don't want to like throw cold water on what they're doing. I think that
Jen, we love a curmudgeon, and literally, like, we cannot affect change without being difficult, you know, or difficult is even like the wrong loaded word, because I think it's often applied to women when they are trying to affect change. But we need to demand what is actually helpful.
And we need to leverage our knowledge and our expertise in doing so. I mean, I occupy this odd space, both in menstruation and menopause, where it's a lot of doctors and a lot of medical experts. And I've been so lucky to work with many of them, and whose knowledge and wisdom and experience that I wouldn't have ever even been able to imagine what kinds of policy reforms might be possible. And but I'm a sort of an odd duck as a lawyer who thinks about this stuff. So I'll play the part of curmudgeon happily, but I don't want to discourage CEOs, I guess is my point. I don't want it to seem like I'm sort of mocking them.
That's one leg of a stool, right? Like we, there need to be other legs to keep this thing upright and working.
There are other legs, and they can't stop there. And if they do stop there, they're not doing right by us. So I want to make that point clear.
Well, let's get to 4 and 5, because I know you said they should actually be 1 and 2.
1 and 2 in reverse.
Yes.
They rank equally to me, but I have to do them in order since I'm speaking and things need to be linear. So I will say that in two parts, that the federal government in particular has an obligation to both correct the record when it comes to the WHI. And by correcting the record, I mean in part having, if that means having a press statement or doing something affirmative and full-throated to make clear the things we do know about MHT and the things we don't know about MHT, we need a new starting line. We can't all be sort of futzing and fumbling around with what we know and have learned since 2002. Some folks didn't know anything about this until maybe they've heard this podcast. Some folks just think they know what they know about MHT because their doctor said so, or their friend said so, or their mother said so. So we need a record reset. And I think it's incumbent on the National Institutes of Health and other leaders in medical research and communications all the way from the top to do that. And there are other federal agency moves that are also implicated by that murky message. So one example would be that there are still warnings on vaginal estrogen products that are mandated by the FDA that seem really outdated compared to what we know now.
Or what you see in other countries on
what
you see
in the UK
in terms of vaginal estrogen. There's no big, scary black box warning.
Right. We're way behind on that. And that's all rooted in not having this sort of affirmative starting line and agreed upon reality that's rooted in science. So that's piece one. And then piece two is, it sounds sort of corny to call it a menopause moonshot, but that's what I've sort of been calling it. When people say,
I'm so excited. Keep going.
Right? To take on a new research agenda, to take on a modern WHI, people say, oh, that would be so hard. It would be billions of dollars. Well, we're worth billions of dollars. We're half the population, and half of us are going to get here eventually and spend a good, you know, hopefully the better part of our lives here.
And it's going to also cost us billions of dollars to deal with the tsunami of suffering that occurs when people have osteoporosis and cardiac impacts and Alzheimer's. Right. I mean, those things have a price tag as well. And if we can't figure out how to help women avoid or mitigate some of these, you know, long-term, this is why it's a public health crisis.
Exactly. So it's both things. It's how to invest in us so that we are our best selves. And it's also how to invest so that we don't bear the burden of pain, both physically and economically, that will be our nation's reality. So that investment, we know that there are moves to already catalyze that. There's the Women's Research Health Initiative out of the White House that's being led by First Lady Jill Biden. And just a week or two ago, they announced the first tranche of funding that's coming from it. It's $100 million, which is a start. It's obviously a drop in the bucket, but it's a start. And it's also not fully devoted to menopause. It's devoted to women in midlife. And menopause is obviously a key component, but it's not the only component. There's federal legislation, in particular, the Menopause Research and Equity Act, which would sort of zero in a little bit more on both menopause and the the role of the National Institute for Health and its own research arm and funding allocations. So that legislation coupled with the White House initiative are really important drivers of this menopause moonshot. They're not the only ones, but they're the ones we have in front of us now. And we shouldn't sort of act like they're small or that they're here, like that they fell out of the sky. It was a lot of people's work that made those happen. And so the time is now to really invest in those. And I would say that the other piece of that research story that is critical is that we know both through observational research and through extraordinary narrative and storytelling platforms like the Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, that there are indeed known and acknowledged racial disparities in how menopause presents itself and how communities address it and how treatment is administered and care is administered. So all of the research we do is obliged to ensure that it is looking at women holistically, that it is encompassing the most inclusive and diverse array of people and their experiences. So anyway, so we did that in reverse order. Three, like I said, workplace, commerce, and education, I feel like are distinct collateral damage. And then research and resetting the narrative are also collateral damage, but they're simultaneously the basis on which all other reforms have to be built going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I love that you brought up Omishadi Birney Scott. I know that she's been a guest on the show. She is the creator of the Black Girl's Guide to Menopause. She has co-written numerous articles with you. I've seen them in Oprah Magazine, and she is a wonderful voice for all menopausal women and all women, you know, the different impact that menopause has on women of color and people of color. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm going to link out to Omi's show in the show notes for anyone who's listening to this episode who has not yet had the pleasure of hearing her. I also want to segue into how we might act upon the sort of list of recommendations and priorities that you identified, right? We need to have greater menopause equity across the board. You and I are connected because we both sit on the board of the national nonprofit Let's Talk Menopause, which is an education and advocacy group. Let's Talk Menopause is active along with you and many, many other people who are fighting the good fight to advance the congressional bill, the Menopause Equity and Research Act of 2023. So before we move into our speed round, I would love if you could offer some concrete actionable ideas for listeners to get in action, because I'm sure many people listening to this show are thinking, I want to be part of the solution. Is it writing their congressperson? Is it demanding something different in their workplace? Is it something that they're taking in their own civic circle, their own community? What would you recommend to a motivated listener about how they can get involved and help move the needle?
So I would recommend all of the above of what you just said in terms of,
all of the above. I love it.
That was my SAT go-to. I mean, in terms of contacting your representatives in Congress about the live legislation, there's another act as well called, oh my gosh, the acronym is the WARM Act. We are addressing menopause, maybe, is what it stands for. But there are two active bills in Congress. And Let's Talk Menopause has real easy tools for people to write to your representative. It's just a matter of putting in your name and clicking send to your own representative. So that's a really simple one to do. It does entail, I think, being vocal as you can in the places where you have voice and influence, whether that is your workplace, whether that is a community group or a book group, whether that is on social media, if that's where you communicate with people. But I think that letting folks know that there are sources and nonprofits and places where not only they can get information for their own health, but where they can be civic engagers on this issue. And I would point to the menstruation space as a really vital example. I would often talk to young people. It's a movement that is very occupied by youth, and it would be sort of scary to them to think about policy that sounded so grown up, or like having to like march on up the steps of the U.S. Senate or something. And it's really not. It's not a scary thing to do. And it's a highly, highly impactful thing to do in terms of pressing people in power to take action, to know that they're supported in doing this. But to lead by example and demonstrate that to those around you. I would say that even going to your own state representatives or municipal representatives, if you live in a big city, because I think there's a movement underfoot to start bringing some of this to state and local legislatures. And I have created, in addition to this 5-point plan, a similar kind of adjacent program or like sister agenda for state and local legislators, where they can sort of tap the same ideas, but different levers of power. So whereas the federal government might be administering federal research funds, state governments also have oversight over their state university systems, which can lend itself to improved medical education or allocation of research dollars. And same could be said for big city governments too. So there's a state and city version of this as well. And so this is something to even bring to local lawmakers.
Yeah, such a good reminder that we have more than one lever to pull, and that our elected officials are part of our communities and they're here to serve us. So make your voice heard, reach out to all of your different local elected officials, including your congressional ones. Thank you, Jens, for that incredible reminder. All right, we're moving into our speed round. You're going to have to come back when period full stop, the politics of menopause is out, because there's so many things we could talk about. But we're moving into our speed round because our time together is coming to an end. So this is just quick sort of 1 to 2 word answers. All right?
I'm ready.
All right. I could talk about this women's health equity topic again and again.
Menstruation and menopause.
Nice. Who is a menopause health thought leader to have on our radar?
Dr. Sharon Malone, the most important person to talk to in my book.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. She's coming on the show in a few weeks, and I've had the pleasure of hearing her talk in public at different menopause events. And she's so smart and thoughtful and inspiring. I would follow her anywhere.
I will follow her anywhere.
If we want to do a deeper dive in terms of policy and how it impacts women's health, what is a book besides your own that you would recommend?
I have really relied on a report actually called Reimagining Policy in Pursuit of Black Justice, that was put out by the National Black Women's Reproductive Justice Agenda in 2023.
Okay, phenomenal. I'm going to try to find that and link out to it. We are recording this show during International Women's Month. Who is a women's health trailblazer that you admire?
The women's health trailblazers that I admire are all of the women who put together the Our Bodies, Ourselves book, the Boston Women's Health Collective, in the 1970s, and continue to make that information available on their website.
Oh, nice. I'm going to link out to that as well. Okay. We've talked a lot about menopause in terms of policy, but I know you've written about the fact that menopause is also a social cultural experience as well. Is there a movie, book, or a show that you think gets menopause and menopausal women right?
Yes. And it interestingly goes back to the 1970s. I think one of the most radical representations of menopause was Edith Bunker on All in the Family in 1972.
Okay. Oh my gosh. I feel like I need to like rewatch that show through this lens. That's so fascinating. Why?
It's so much more progressive than you might ever imagine. Can we go off speed round for a second so I can give a slightly longer answer? So there's a section in my book about pop culture and menopause, and it's really fascinating that the representations of menopause over the decades from the 70s through today are so reflective of the environments in which they were raised. And in the 70s, one, hormone treatment wasn't a pariah, so it is treated with complete normalcy on this episode of All in the Family, which I think is so refreshing and almost looks radical to watch. It's Gloria, the daughter, who tells Edith about why and how she should be taking menopause hormone treatment. And it's not all these like silly punchlines either. Archie Bunker obviously is like good for, you know, a good one-liner, but it's actually a really smart representation. And it led to the show Maude, one of seven spinoffs of All in the Family. And Maude's, the treatment of Maude B. Arthur, the amazing B. Arthur, of her reproductive life as a late 40s woman is also really radical. You may recall she has an abortion. She talks about menopause. It's really such forward-thinking television. And honestly, anything we see today, from Fleabag, which I know has the very famous monologue, to the Sex and the City reboot, which, whose name I'm forgetting right now because I don't watch it, none of that actually holds a candle to what Norman Lear did for menopause in the 70s.
Okay, first of all, I'm so thrilled I asked this question because I am literally going to hit the Google rabbit hole when we wrap recording and go check out those episodes. I cannot wait. Thank you for putting those on our radar. Okay, this is my last question before we say goodbye. Finally, your one-word answer to complete this sentence. As I age, I feel...
fabulous.
Fabulous. I love it. I love it.
I love aging.
Me too. I am with you. And by the way, I feel smarter after having this conversation and having you join me today. So thank you very much. Before we say goodbye, how can our listeners keep following you, your work, and learn more about when your book is ready to drop?
So the book comes out next year, period, full stop, The Politics of Menopause. It's published by NYU Press. I am present on social media, but I'm not a big social media maven. Folks are welcome to hop over to my Instagram, but you'll see as many pictures of my kids and my New Year's Day swim extravaganzas as you will about menopause policy.
Everyone needs to hop over to Jen's Instagram on January 2nd and check out her latest polar plunge.
Exactly.
This has been such a treat. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Best way to spend the morning.
This wraps A Certain Age, a show for women who are aging without apology. And before I say goodbye, two quick favors. First, can you please forward this episode to your girlfriend text thread, the one you've got going with all the women in your life? We need to spread the word and raise our collective voices to demand greater menopause equity. Second, we would love a 5-star podcast review. If you learned something on today's show, if you've got some easy ideas you're going to start using immediately, please take 5 minutes to write a short review over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Every review helps. And don't forget, we're starting to take listener questions on the show. You can DM me yours over on Instagram at A Certain Age Pod or hit me up over email, katie@acertainagepod.com. Special thanks to Michael Mancini, who composed and produced our theme music. See you next time. And until then, age boldly, beauties.